Saddam Hussein and his sons must leave Iraq within 48 hours. Their refusal to do so will result in military conflict, commenced at a time of our choosing.
Dit zei president Bush 5 jaar geleden. 5 jaar geleden toen de bewijzen keihard waren. 5 jaar geleden. Toen de coalitie trots was en de doelen nog duidelijk. Tegenlicht viert het wrange lustrum van de oorlog in Irak met de vraag: hoe werd deze oorlog aan ons verkocht?
Enough to fill tens upon tens upon tens of thousands of teaspoons.
Good afternoon. I'm pleased to be joined today by Air Marshal Brian Burridge, Great Britain, Brigadier Murray McNairn of Australia, Rear Admiral Per T. Demond from Denmark, Lieutenant Colonel Jan Blom from the Netherlands. 4 coalition partners represented here with us, and
66 uur nadat de eerste bommen op Bagdad vielen, leek het voor een miljoenen publiek alsof Nederland de inval in Irak niet alleen politiek, maar ook militair steunde.
Ik ben meteen gebeld om te vertellen wat er gebeurd is. Dat er iemand van ons aanwezig was bij een persconferentie die ging over de aanval op Irak.
Ik was verbijsterd. Ik was totaal verbijsterd.
Er is geen Nederlandse militaire bijdrage.
Premier Balkenende wist van niks, hè?
Ja, dat heb ik ook gehoord.
Wij wisten dat hij naar een bijeenkomst zou gaan met een Amerikaanse generaal en met andere hoge officieren. Maar hadden ons absoluut niet gerealiseerd dat het een persconferentie zou zijn. Daar moesten wij niet zijn.
Foutje, bedankt.
Ja, nee, meer. Die man die zat in Kadar en per ongeluk liep die door het beeld.
Ik heb wel de ambassadeur in Washington gisteren opdracht gegeven om ook tegen de Amerikanen te zeggen dat dit natuurlijk niet de bedoeling is.
Als Nederland die inval in Irak niet militair steunde, waarom stond Jan Blom daar dan op dat podium als vertegenwoordiger van de Coalition of the Willing?
Right, the Coalition of the Willing.
Ron Suskind, voormalig verslaggever voor de Wall Street Journal, was in de eerste jaren van de regering Bush een van de weinige journalisten die toegang had tot het Witte Huis.
Willing. Well, let's think of what willing means. Willing means that you're embracing free will. That people are doing what they think is right. That they're not being coerced, they're not having their arms twisted, they're not being told either you're with us and willing or you're against us and your puppy chow. That's where words like willing come back to haunt you.
Every nation in every region now has a decision to make. Either you are with us or you are with the terrorists.
Black or white, you must choose appropriately. We are not requesting any questions as to how we frame this, and you need to make a decision immediately.
The manifestation of that I like to talk about was this huge chart, which essentially had countries across the top from Albania to Uzbekistan, and it had down the left-hand side, as I recall, it had those items of money, overflight rights, troops, police.
Al op de avond van 11 september maakt stafchef Lawrence Wilkerson samen met de minister van Buitenlandse Zaken Colin Powell een inventarisatie van mogelijke coalitiepartners.
So this was a fairly elaborate matrix that said we have 100 plus countries in the world who are very interested in saving civilization from this kind of jihadist terrorism. And these are the kinds of things that each of them can offer us. Now let's go out through diplomacy and try to get these things. We knew we wouldn't get them all.
Wanneer het Witte Huis zich in de loop van 2002 begint warm te lopen voor een mogelijke inval in Irak, wordt wat in eerste instantie een brede coalitie tegen het terrorisme was, al snel een coalitie voor een inval in Irak, waarmee het aantal bereidwillige landen afneemt.
The public affairs campaign, the public diplomacy campaign surrounding the coalition became not a laughing stock, but it certainly became something that many of us who were realists and understood what was happening thought about in terms of, my God, how low can we sink? They were claiming that this is a robust coalition, and look at it. The only really solid, meaningful contribution in terms of troops on the ground, boots on the ground, was coming from Tony Blair and the United Kingdom. And everything else just fell off after that into virtually nothing.
Als je een oorlog naar keuze wilt verkopen, is het wel belangrijk een casus belli te hebben. Een reden om ten strijde te trekken.
At that particular time, I think there were some people in the White House who more or less communications types, strategic communications types, who convinced the president and others that we ought to make a shot at the international community, the American people, and the UN Security Council with the best intelligence that we had.
When it's a war of choice, as this clearly was, you do need to figure out a way to get from point A, non-war, to point B, war.
De van oorsprong Nederlandse Ivo Daalder werkt voor het Brookings Instituut, een denktank in Washington. Ook is hij buitenlandadviseur van presidentskandidaat Barack Obama.
There was always the hope that there would be an effect, I think the expectation, that once you had a UN resolution, Saddam Hussein would do something that would become a smoking gun. They would either find some weapons, he would prevent inspectors from going into a certain building. There would be a casus belli. There would be a real trigger that would unite the international community, force the international community to pass another resolution. By January of 2003, Bush and Blair are getting particularly worried that this is not happening.
And so almost at the last minute, the White House makes a decision to do this, and Dr. Rice, then the National Security Advisor, gives, as I recall, Secretary Powell a call and lets him know he's going to be the person to give the briefing. The Secretary walks into my office. We had adjoining offices, and he walks through my door, as he often did, and he says, I'm going to be giving a presentation at the UN that's going to summarize all our intelligence on Iraq. I want you to get out to the CIA, and I want you to put this together for me. And I'm in shock. When are we giving this? Well, we're giving it in 6 days and 5 nights. I'm supposed to go to the CIA and put all this together in that amount of time for you to go to the United Nations to do an Adlai Stevenson, Cuban Missile Crisis type presentation? And he hands me this 48-page script. And I said, where is this from? And he says, this was written in the vice president's office. My heart sunk immediately in the vice president's office. I bet this is a winner.
Now, remind you, the clock is ticking. It's like you're cramming for a final in college. You haven't even sat in on the course. You haven't read the books, but you're cramming, and you've only got now 2 days, now 1 day. Powell starts to push back against it and says, I'm not going in with this stuff. I don't know where this comes from.
Dick Cheney and Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz, you know, all believed that, you know, that they didn't have to prove the case, that the argument was strong enough, but for public consumption, they had to throw out, you know, make it seem as if it was a rock solid case.
When I began to explain to the graphics people at the CIA the complexity of what I was envisioning for the presentation, and as the secretary began to make demands in that first day that we went out to he went out and went over the possibilities, we understood quickly that it was well beyond the CIA's technical capability to do this. And so you know, we started looking around for something else. And my memory serves me right. It was Dr. Rice who offered to Secretary Powell the White House team, because that was the ultimate in technical expertise available to the government. Without going to New York or Hollywood and hiring someone, you know.
Binnen het Witte Huisteam is Scott Sforza de man die verantwoordelijk is voor de beeldvorming. Als voormalig producer van ABC bedenkt en ontwerpt hij historische televisiemomenten van Bush als piloot. Bush met zijn Mission Accomplished. En Bush met generaal Tommy Franks in Doha in Qatar. Sforza praat uit principe nooit met de pers.
An artist doesn't have to be someone who is creating only great, beautiful good. You know, it could be great, beautiful, evil.
Filmmaker Greg Allen volgt Sforza's werk al jaren nauwgezet. Hij noemt Sforza een geniale vakman.
What I think Sforza did was bring, and he brought an understanding of how that message is communicated, meaning how do television news networks put together a story and put together a picture? What do they need? He knew what that was, and he went to the other side, to the political side, and said, I will create everything that you need.
If you talk about cinema, you talk about a film, you talk about a good movie, he was the producer and director.
One of my favorite Sforzian techniques is this what I call the human wallpaper. By putting them in the background of the shot, you get the president and who he's talking to, even though they're behind him. There's something interesting in the image. It's composed. It's not an accidental image. And you know, everything from deciding where the camera would go to deciding what the background would look like to even the captions and what are the words that would go underneath or behind.
Sir, we're honored. Welcome to you.
I remember one of the things that occurred at the very last minute on the floor of the UN Security Council. One of his team members came over and said, let's move the microphone to here. And I said, why are you moving the secretary's microphone? You know, I don't know anything about this business. And he says, because we want the microphone buried in the knot of his tie. That way the microphone will not be seen. And sure enough, if you look at it, except when the secretary moves a little bit, you can't see the microphone. It's buried right in the knot of his tie. And he had done all the calibrations. Secretary's height, where his tie was, the chair, everything. The angle of the cameras, not just one camera, but the angle of the cameras. And he had figured out exactly where to put that microphone.
Mr. President, Mr. Secretary General, distinguished colleagues, I would like to begin by expressing my thanks for the special effort that each of you made to be here today.
What happens is that basically the administration looks at the selling of the war, again, just like selling a bar of soap. Whatever the facts are, we're not going to go through a process of an evidentiary search. We're going to gather what we need, understanding that if everything is marked classified and if we can control things tightly with real penalties for violation of a message, that we can we will never have anyone asking the informed question. By then we will have won in Iraq, and by then we'll be moving forward, and all of this will be very much past tense, you know, pedantic and meaningless. That was the view. Go forward. It's a little bit like the way Enron did accounting, okay?
My colleagues, every statement I make today is backed up by sources, solid sources. These are not assertions. What we're giving you are facts and conclusions based on solid intelligence. I am no expert on centrifuge tubes, but just as an old army trooper, I can tell you a couple of things.
Powell is viewed as valuable because he is so credible still, even in early 2003.
The vice president probably thought something like this. Let Colin go. He's got high poll ratings. His poll ratings are like Mother Teresa. They're in the high 70s, the low 80s. He's the only one in the administration who has that kind of credibility with the American people. Let him go. If he fails, it won't make any difference. We're going to go to war anyway. If he succeeds, then maybe we got a few more people on our side. And so let him go. Let him go. last rehearsal that we had atop the U.S. UN mission in New York, in the cafeteria there, as I recall, Secretary Powell finished his last rehearsal, which was only had a couple of interruptions. He went through the whole thing, and he turned to Mr. Tenet, who was sitting on his right. I was sitting on his left. And he turned to Mr. Tenet, and he said, "You stand by everything in this presentation, right, George?" And Mr. Tenet made some remark to the effect of, "Yes, if I'm wrong, I'll have to go before my oversight committees in the Congress, and I'm more worried about them than I am you." And the Secretary said, "Well, that's good, George, because you're going to be with me tomorrow. You're going to be in camera. You're going to be with me."
He has not told the truth. One of these lies is...
And the Secretary did that on purpose because he wanted George to know that what he was saying was what George had given him to say, what the American and other intelligence communities had given him to say. And I think Mr. Tenet knew that.
It is all a web of lies. What's being hidden? Why? There's only one answer to the why. To deceive. To hide. Here you see 15 munitions bunkers in yellow and red outlines.
It was full of evidence and full of, you know, photographic evidence from satellite photos. And this little vial that he was doing this, you know, like a prop.
It's the entrex.
Yeah. That everything was really designed to look like court testimony.
And dry agent of this type is the most lethal form for human beings.
Was there real anthrax in the little bottle?
No, that was just, I think it was talcum powder or something like that. That was a dramatic moment.
I'm kind of glad in a way that, you know, even Colin Powell can't walk into the middle of the UN with a bottle of anthrax. But, you know, in terms of theater and in terms of emotional power, I can't see that. That can't be his idea.
As I recall, it was in the DCI conference room, the George Tenet's conference room out at Langley, and they were just trying to figure a way to, you know, break the tedium. Because here he is reading for an hour and 10-20 minutes at that point. In fact, at that point, I think it was about an hour and 30 minutes because he was going to cut some more of the things out that he didn't like. But it just was so boring, you know, reading. And so someone suggested, I forget who it was, that you know, there ought to be some visual aids to break the tedium.
Thousands of teaspoons. And Saddam Hussein has not verifiably accounted for even one teaspoonful of this deadly material.
If Colin Powell believes this, and there was no doubt in my mind, no doubt in Colin Powell's mind, that he believed it, that the way he brought it, then it must be true. It was an extraordinarily powerful use of this man.
Part of me said, I know what they feel about message. I know what they feel about what creates message. It can be whipped cream, it can be next to nothing. But they wouldn't do it when it came to an act of war, of bringing a country to war. Nobody would do that.
At the end of the briefing, I was sitting on the floor of the National Security Council. At the end of the briefing was the first time I had seen that presentation from start to finish without any interruptions. And so, really, it was the first time I had grasped the whole presentation. And I thought to myself, what a failure. I went outside in the cold February air in New York City and I walked around for a few minutes and I thought, what a failure that was, because it was all circumstantial. Many of the ingredients of that presentation could be understood two ways.
Powell's speech at the UN was remarkable in that everything he said was false or wrong. It wasn't like most of it was wrong. It wasn't that a lot of it was wrong. Basically, every claim he made about WMDs and what he called the sinister nexus between Al-Qaeda and Iraq were wrong.
It
In Nederland neemt het demissionair kabinet Balkenende 1 de dreiging van de massavernietigingswapens voor waar aan en steunt de Amerikanen bij de inval in Irak.
Nederland geeft daar een politieke steun aan de ingezette actie tegen Saddam Hussein. Vrijheid en veiligheid, ook voor de inwoners van Irak zelf, is daarbij het hoogste doel.
To say that, well, as an ally, you probably know best, which was the Dutch attitude. In some sense, we will support the United States because that's what one does as a good ally. Has some value and is understandable to a certain extent. But when it comes to a highly debatable use of force, when it comes to a use of force that, under normal circumstances, the Dutch government, let alone the parliament, would not support, there's a real question of what is it that you're trying to buy.
The normal horse trading goes on. I mean, there's no question about, for example, hypothetically speaking now, I'm not describing an actual situation because I don't know, but I suspect in Uzbekistan, I'm sure our ambassador had to say some things like, yes, there will be aid forthcoming, yes, there will be several hundred million dollars, yes, we will pay you rent for the base, and that sort of thing. I mean, sure, that had to go on.
There's a belief that by being supportive of the United States might be more supportive of activities and or desires that the Netherlands would have. For example, if you would like to have a Dutchman become the next NATO Secretary General, it may help if you are supportive of the United States in one instance, because then the United States may support you for your bid to high office in a future instance.
Many of these things take place without any spoken word. It's sort of like I know what you're thinking and you know what I'm thinking, and you know, that's the end of the conversation. It's never sign right here, you contribute this and we'll contribute this. It's an understanding that takes place maybe without words being spoken to or articulated.
Well, again, one of the problems is that when you come up with elegant phrases, because that's the goal, after all, in terms of the management of messages, the creation of message, to come up with elegant, you know, quicksilver phrases that just float off your tongue, the axis of evil, the coalition of the willing, is that when the hollowness of those phrases become clear at some point, because maybe they haven't been thought through, they become punchlines. Essentially, they become the thing that you then are tied in knots by, that you have to wear, like wearing a dunce cap.
Al weken voordat Colin Powell zijn speech voor de Verenigde Naties houdt, begint het Pentagon in Doha in Qatar al een internationaal perscentrum te bouwen, van waaruit de oorlog en uiteindelijk ook de Coalition of the Willing gepresenteerd moet worden.
I was at Central Command in Doha. I was in the little office we had at the time. It was during construction, and we were watching on TV. We watched it live, which would have been, I think it was in the middle of the day here at the UN, but it was in the evening, late evening over there in Qatar.
I had arrived right before when the country was really still in the midst of an intense battle about what should we do. Should we do this, or should we give it more time for the inspectors?
Did you believe him?
You know, it's embarrassing to say that now, that I believed it. But it would be a lie to say otherwise.
Luitenant Josh Rushing werkte voor het Pentagon in Los Angeles, waar hij filmscenario's beoordeelde. Een goed scenario kon rekenen op militaire bijdrage in de vorm van straaljagers, troepen of wapentuig. Rushing wordt woordvoerder voor de Amerikaanse troepen in Qatar.
I immediately went online and found the transcript of the speech, and I printed it out and I made copies of it, and I highlighted all the important sections in the copies. And as new public affairs people were coming in, because we ended up having dozens of people in the office and I was one of the first ones there, I would give them this speech and make sure that they read it, so we were all on the same sheet of music, because here were the facts.
Luitenant Mark Kitchens werkte ooit op de persafdeling van Bill Clinton in het Witte Huis. En hij wordt nu ook opgeroepen om als woordvoerder voor US Central Command in Qatar te komen werken.
What he was saying and the arguments that he was making validated in our I think in our minds why we were there. And we understood after that presentation in very grave terms why we were there and what we were there to do.
Clearly these were the philosophical marching orders from the highest level. There were these massive warehouses where equipment was stored, vehicles. In case there ever was a war in Iraq after Desert Storm in 91, they built this base and just built tons of warehouses on it so they could keep a lot of equipment over there and quickly move it up rather than having to ship it all the way from the States. And so we set up Bedouin tents in these warehouses, and we were living inside a tent inside a warehouse. And we took one of the warehouses and we were building a media center, putting satellites there and telling the world's media this is where you'll want to come for that big press conference that'll happen every day.
The majority of that building was for the briefing room, for the American officers on one side of it, but the majority of the area was for the international press that was going to be there, and they were expecting many hundreds.
Colonel Alan Lockwood was woordvoerder voor de aanwezige Britse troepen en verantwoordelijk voor de Britse voorlichters en embedded journalisten.
Subsequently, some 750 journalists, television crews, arrived. And most of these journalists, incidentally, weren't defense journalists. They were political journalists. And some very, very important ones from throughout the world were there.
It seemed not only the biggest story in the world, but the biggest media story. So those two things converged, and it was irresistible. And also my magazine was willing to buy a first-class ticket.
Shortly before the invasion, a White House staffer, if you will, I guess, named Jim Wilkinson, a 32-year-old Republican worker from the White House, was made the communications czar of all Central Command.
Jim Wilkinson was deel van een select groepje van Bush-getrouwen, die in de zomer van 2002 de strategie ontwikkelde hoe de oorlog te verkopen. Hij had Bush aan zijn verkiezingsoverwinning geholpen en wordt nu vanuit Washington naar Central Command in Qatar gestuurd om de oorlogsberichtgeving te creëren en te controleren.
I found him an overconfident, egotistical, controlling individual. He was only one way, and that was Jim Wilkinson's way. And he felt that he had this enormous power. And he felt that he had to have the final say in everything. I found one of the most amusing things was that he never had any military experience, although he turned up one day in uniform, the next day he was a colonel, and fairly shortly after that he was a two-star general.
And Jim knew how to run a campaign, because that's what he had done, but he didn't necessarily know how to run a military information operation, because that's not what his experience was.
They used to start at 4:30 in the morning, by deciding what they were going to brief almost 12 hours later.
Military guys don't normally do this. Military guys, you know, they just put up a tent and put out their information. But political guys, politicians, are very aware of this stuff. They're very savvy about it.
Coalition Special Operations Forces entered Iraq at night after destroying Iraqi military outposts, as this short video shows. You will see two clips. The first is an outpost along the border, and the second is a building that supported observers on the border.
Right from the very beginning, I said I will not use video footage of bombing or any other thing that shows us knocking hell out of Iraq. It's not what we're here to do. We're here to liberate the country, not to blow it apart. The Americans insisted on showing this video throughout their press conferences.
He wanted the message to be that this is the most high-tech army the world has ever known. And so the way he conveyed that was with these six flat screens, which were brand new at the time.
Ook hier is Scott Sforza verantwoordelijk voor de wijze waarop de oorlog gepresenteerd wordt.
I think this was the real genius of Scott Sforza. He did not actually have an unlimited budget for all of his productions, but he made what is, to me, looks like a very professional television studio. With a television set for only $250,000. This is like, it's quite an achievement. That's the first sense that when I saw it, I realized that this is actually not just one angle or two angles. What he had done was create a full 360-degree shooting environment. So no matter which angle you choose as a camera person or photographer, they know exactly what you're going to be shooting.
Well, what he wanted was an impressive backdrop to show off the capability of America. Had the Stars and Stripes, subsequently we did manage to get some other coalition flags involved as well, but it was Stars and Stripes, the American Eagle, the American DOD crest, and it was America.
So where were the British?
The British were in two small rooms around the back.
Well, the war began on the 19th, and everyone wanted the press conference. They wanted General Franks out there on the stage saying, we've crossed the line of departure, we are now in Iraq, the war has begun.
We were fully aware in the UK camp that operations were going to commence that night. And obviously, my role was to be available first thing in the morning to prepare a briefing to present to the press exactly what had gone on that evening. 3 o'clock in the morning, I was woken from my bed and told that there'd been a crash and we'd lost 8 troops.
Central Command Public Affairs said nothing, gave out no press release. It was, we were ordered essentially to stand down. We were silent.
That second night, the United States Army shot down one of our Tornadoes and killed 2 of our air crew. Once again, 3 o'clock in the morning, I was woken from my bed. The bad news was broken. And I was in the fire brigade. The Americans still weren't saying anything.
What we found was that for a period of about 2 or 3 days, we really couldn't confirm anything. And when I say anything, we couldn't communicate anything. It was information lockdown. I've never seen anything like that in my life.
And on the third night, 2 of our Sea King helicopters collided in midair and killed 12 of our servicemen.
And they were going crazy, the reporters. As the minutes went on, they were going crazy because they had embedded reporters with those troops. They knew from their own people that the war had begun. It's not like we were keeping information from them. We couldn't keep them in the dark.
The Americans had decided at that stage they were going to run the whole of their press campaign from Washington. Any announcements to be made were to be made in Washington.
As hours went on, they were becoming angry. As days went on with no information, they were furious. I mean enraged, furious.
You step in here and you realize, I have no information. I have come here to get information, and I have now entered into an environment, a facility designed to tell me nothing.
Nothing was released from Qatar at all.
You know, you're sitting next to someone and everybody is complaining, we really don't know. We don't know anything, we don't have anything, there is no story, negative, negative, negative. It just there is, it's a blank sheet of paper, essentially. Look at my notebook, nothing. And then those same people will get up, go to their setup, stand behind the camera, and make it seem like, you know, not only do they know the most inside information, but they're the only one who knows the inside information, and they really have gotten it, and it really is important. And then the lights go off and camera goes on, and they go like this, you know, what could I do?
Quickly, we started to see that we were being run more like a political operation than a military operation. Now, the difference is, in a military operation, like I said before, it's maximum disclosure with minimum delay. In a political operation, you're trying to shape the message. You want to guide people's opinions. You want people to believe a certain thing. That's not what a military public affairs person does. That's what a public relations person does. And the difference is it's much greater than you might presume in the way you go about doing those two things.
Eindelijk verschijnt opperbevelhebber Tommy Franks op het podium, geflankeerd door de Coalition of the Willing.
Good afternoon. I'm pleased to be joined today by Air Marshal Brian Burridge, Great Britain, Brigadier Murray McNairn of Australia, Rear Admiral Per T. de Mond from Denmark, Lieutenant Colonel Jan Blom from the Netherlands.
I do remember seeing it. I do remember wondering what a military man that was doing there when he wasn't participating in the military operation that was being briefed. This is what, 2 or 3 days after the war starts.
The first thing I notice is the different camouflage in the background on all the different soldiers standing behind him. A whole range of different camouflage that has been sort of costumed, I guess. I mean, I know that every single one of them is probably the official camouflage of their country, but the way it's set up, it is just perfectly a coalition. It's beautiful.
In hoeverre waren de andere militairen op het podium zich bewust van de rol die zij die dag speelden? We bellen met de Britse opperbevelhebber, Brian Burridge.
I was the UK's joint commander of the UK's force of 43,000 personnel.
So you were inside working together with General Franks?
Correct.
And how did you end up on that stage that day?
Well, I was the UK's national commander. I'm the same as General Franks. So it was the most obvious thing in the world that I would be at a joint press conference.
What was the message that came out during this press conference from your point of view?
Well, no message, because I didn't say anything.
Did you ask to say anything?
I didn't think I needed to ask. I expected that it had been set up as a coalition press conference, and I thought I would make a statement.
And when did you realize that this would not happen?
About 15 minutes before.
And did you protest?
Yeah, I said, well, it was a bit late to protest. I said, well, you know, what is the plan for coalition partners? And nothing.
And this was Jim Wilkinson who was communicating this?
Correct.
You want to know the rules of message. The rules are images matter. Pictures matter more than words. Right? This is traditional message logic. The fact is that most people will not have the time, the energy, the attention to dig into the particulars. They'll see the picture. They'll have a visceral reaction.
Could you describe your feeling while...
I was very angry, because here is the UK with 43,000 troops, 25% of the armour, and yet the press conference was orchestrated such that myself and my Australian colleague, whose contribution wasn't so large but nevertheless significant, were there simply as wallpaper.
He wasn't happy. He felt he'd been used just to stand behind there. In hindsight, he far outranked the officers that were there with him. And my belief was he'd felt he'd been used as window dressing to enhance the Americans' image that they wanted to give, that it was a coalition of the willing, shall we say.
When you came off stage, what did you do?
I said to my my head of media that we would not do another coalition press conference of that sort ever, and we did not.
Best to you.
Did you spoke to Lieutenant Colonel Jan Blom afterwards?
No. I didn't know the other two at all. They did not appear in the coalition command group.
Did you realize what the position of the Netherlands was within the coalition of the willing?
Yes, I knew. Absolutely.
Did you wonder why he was there on stage?
It crossed my mind that, and it was possibly his presence that made me realize that this wasn't a serious coalition press conference. This was an American press conference.
It was an insult, really, to the expertise and the commitment of the other nations there.
This just demonstrated how fake it was. You even had to have military props, in the sense of having a military man from a country that was not participating in the military operation to prove that the coalition was in fact bigger than it was.
So they found someone with the right set of pajamas and had them standing beside him. That's just, you know, typical misleading spin. And I don't know what the action was in Holland to that, but in America, it really didn't matter. at that point, when our troops are rushing, you know, into Baghdad, you know, towards Baghdad, and we have our reporters embedded with them, no one in America would care that, you know, a lieutenant colonel from Denmark or Holland or Spain or Costa Rica was standing behind Tommy Franks.
And the fact is, if it was only, you know, Denmark, Australia, and Britain behind Tommy Franks, it would actually look kind of paltry. There would be no balance to the picture. You'd have two guys on one side of Franks and one guy on the other side. That violates framing, image, and almost like set design principles that, you know, that Ingmar Bergman might use to say, you know, that's the way I want it to look.
Luitenant-kolonel Jan Blom had zijn kantoortje naast dat van de Deense vice-admiraal Per Tiedemand. Zij werden een dag eerder gevraagd om bij een persconferentie aanwezig te zijn, zonder te beseffen welke persconferentie dat zou worden.
I knew Jan Blom pretty good. We spoke to each other every day. On the 22nd, before we went on stage, we talked about this press conference and we talked about getting permissions from back home. And Jan Blom and I, we both of us had had a telephone call home, and we were permitted to go there.
Could you describe how it was?
We were gathered together with the Australian and the British, and then Tommy Franks came in and said hello, and asked for our names, and he also tried to pronounce them, and then the time was on, and we went into the stage.
Er is geen Nederlandse militaire bijdrage. En dan moet je ook niet bij een persconferentie over dat onderwerp aanwezig zijn.
Nederland werd ook nog geïntroduceerd als lid van de Coalition of the Willing.
Dat geeft een verkeerd beeld.
Ik heb wel de ambassadeur in Washington gisteren opdracht gegeven om ook tegen de Amerikanen te zeggen dat dit natuurlijk niet de bedoeling is.
Premier Balkenende wist van niks, zei hij.
Ja, dat heb ik ook gehoord.
Voortaan niet meer.
Ja, I know, somebody didn't realize the political implications. I know, it's dreadful. Ramifications.
But afterwards, I experienced from Jan that there has been some confusion about this. Or Jan said he had permission to participate in the press conference before he went on. But afterwards, no one that would admit that had happened.
Uh-huh.
That he had got the permission.
So it must have been frustrating for him also.
It was. It sure was.
And how did he feel about this then? I mean, what...
He felt... what do you call it? Not betrayed, but something like that.
Luitenant-kolonel Jan Blom mag van het ministerie van Defensie geen reactie geven.
Forces on the field.
Zo werd de oorlog aan ons, de toeschouwers, verkocht. En de journalisten zaten in de zaal en deden verslag van de opvoering.
And with that, we'd be pleased to take your questions. Please.
There was a disdain for the media at the highest levels. It began at you know, really the White House. They hate the media. Rumsfeld, the way he talked to reporters, you could tell he hated the media. It began at that level. You know, there was a condescending attitude of you're just in our way. That trickled down to our office directly through Jim Wilkinson, for sure. The media was there to be manipulated, to be used for your purposes, but other than that, tell them nothing.
They even lit the audience. They're not an audience, they're working, they're the reporters. But they lit them and they look like an audience. So the whole thing actually feels like a talk show.
But at the same time, you know, this is our job. I mean, it's very hard to say, you know, this is all baloney when we're in elemental part of the baloney.
Jim would have assigned the first couple of rows to different networks. And then after that, there were several rows that were just open and first come, first serve.
I had a question prepared, and then the person before me asked that question. So I was suddenly, with my hand up, I didn't have a question. And at that moment, I was, of course, called on. So very quickly, I'm scanning through my mind, and the only question that I have is the obvious one. the question on everybody's mind, the most fundamental and basic question, which I am forced to ask because I don't have any other question.
I guess my question is, why should we stay? What's the value to us for what we learn at this million-dollar press center?
I've gotten applause already. That's wonderful. I appreciate that.
All the reporters started laughing and applauding. And it was that moment, if you can remember back to childhood, the moment that the class clown really got the teacher, a good one, and all the students laughed, you know, and embarrassed the teacher. But afterward, Jim Wilkinson took him outside and really threatened him and said no more questions for him. That he didn't appreciate that. That his brother was one of the ones up on the front lines, and we didn't need that kind of attitude there.
But he was a kind of a tough guy, so he impugned my manhood and courage and loyalty to my country, et cetera, just the kinds of things that one would expect a tough guy who works for the Pentagon to say.
Colin Powell en George Bush komen op bezoek in Qatar. Het podium is speciaal voor de gelegenheid ingevlogen.
We'll reveal the truth. But one thing is certain. No terrorist network will gain weapons of mass destruction from the Iraqi regime because the Iraqi regime is no more.
But every day the question was asked, where the weapons of mass destruction found?
Yeah, and I used to say, if we haven't found them today, we might find them tomorrow. But we are confident they're there. And I remember saying those words many times. We haven't found them yet. And when I left, we still hadn't found them. And they still haven't found them to this day.
A year later, Secretary Powell went on Meet the Press with Tim Russert. I think it was May of 04. And he said that not only was some of the information that he gave in that February speech to the UN false, but that it appeared to be that some of the intelligence had been shaped to prove a point before the intelligence was even gathered. And I was watching that. I said, oh.
When you come out of a war zone, there is a time that you have to detox, because you so fervently, when you're in danger, you so fervently want to believe in your mission. And that can sometimes shadow your ability to ask the right questions.
I think that Powell realized very quickly that he had committed a kind of sin against democratic ideals and, in a way, against Enlightenment ideals of empiricism, of evidence.
I repeated those lies, and people believed him because I had integrity. And people believed him because my uniform carried a sense of integrity and credibility, and I repeated them.
And it gradually became a feeling of outrage that, how dare these people lie to us? How dare they put us in a position where we were telling people things that were simply not true?
It's hard to overstate how destructive it is to violate a very ancient idea, which is that you do not go to war ever under false pretenses. This is something even dictators are mindful of.
How are you, friend?
Nice to see you.
Good to see you. Welcome.
Good to be here.
Okay. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. President. Nice to see you again.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. President.
Good morning, sir. How are you, sir?
Nice to see you.
Nice.
How are you?
Wonderful. Good to see you.
Nice to see you.
Rice, good morning.
Good to see you.
Good to see you again.
They had sold it, and we had bought it. So that's always the equation that politicians are looking for. If they had sold it and we really hadn't bought it, I think the outcome would have been different.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much. Appreciate this contact, and I think you'll have a fruitful discussion, and we'll cooperate. Thanks for the good contacts. Glad to be here.
Helaas hebben alle door ons benaderde Nederlandse politici en betrokkenen geweigerd aan deze aflevering van Tegenlicht mee te werken. Bagdad, de gevaarlijkste stad ter wereld. Hoe is het om daar puber te zijn? I was thinking to myself, this could be heaven or this could be hell. Gewapend met hun eigen camera's geven vier jongens hun beeld van het dagelijks leven in deze onleefbare stad. Een ontwapenend beeld van de oorlog in Irak. The Boys from Bagdad. Volgende keer in Tegenlicht.